You are listening to Maximilian on the Afterlife Podcast, coming to you with episode 4, Manopause. Crash, thud, slam. Jimmy bounded up the stairs, two at a time. He moved swiftly through the laundry room and kitchen, into the hall, to the front door. A woman lay unconscious among a plastic storage container, a Jamba Juice, and her purse, the contents of each spilt onto the floor. Jimmy ran up to the woman and almost touched her. Then he remembered his condition and drew his hand back before any damage was done. Because how could he really know how it would affect her? How would it affect a living person to get touched by a ghost? What if touching her would connect him to her in some way? He didn't want to have to haunt this woman, whoever she was. Or what if touching her would somehow take some of her life force away? That would be a bummer when all he wanted to do was help. The way she'd fallen, her hair was in her face. He wanted to move it so he could see what she looked like. He had to find a way to do it without touching her hair, because what if his touch made her hair grow out white like that girl Nancy in Friday the 13th? It's not something he'd have considered before, but Jimmy figured that his current state was a clear indication of the possibilities in the universe. Anything can be true and could happen. Jimmy took a visual inventory of the spillage coming out of the lady's purse, then stuck his hand in the flap and dumped the rest out onto the floor. When she came to, she'd probably assume it had happened during her fall. It did look suspicious that all of the contents, even the bottom of the purse fluff, was in a pile, but in the absence of some other explanation, it would be the one that she would have to accept. He felt tentative about touching people, but not about touching objects. He rifled through her stuff. No driver's license. Bus pass. He looked into the container, whose contents were disarranged, but mostly compartmentalized. All natural cleaning supplies. Jimmy wanted to kiss her, this wonderful woman who cared enough to keep the sheets clean and fresh and dust-free in a bedroom that nobody even used. Then he remembered the condoms. What if they were hers? It didn't seem likely. It would take a lot of balls to have sex in a house where you worked as a housekeeper, especially with a home care worker always in the house. Where the fuck was she? Resolving to find something in the housekeeper's purse to move her hair back from her face with, Jimmy recommitted himself to snooping through her personal items. Lots of keys, probably to other people's apartments. Jimmy's place didn't have a key. It opened with a passcode, one of the fancy-pants extras he'd put in when he did the renovations. It had been his dream to have a smart house, one that he could just talk to. That on-voice command would blend him up a protein smoothie, or turn on the music, or unlock the door. He'd almost gotten there. He could do those things remotely, except for the smoothie. Jimmy turned his attention back to the treasures he'd dumped out of the woman's purse. Burt's Bees lip moisturizer, a frosty beige lip color, a CoverGirl brand compact, an iPhone, a half-eaten Subway sandwich, three dirty napkins, and a pin. Jimmy picked up the pin, and with the delicacy of a 5-year-old lifting out the wishbone during the last round in a game of Operation, he looped a clump of her hair with the tip of the pin, actually a stylus, and lifted it, tucking it loosely behind the woman's ear. Her face was unfamiliar, which is what Jimmy had expected, he supposed. He didn't know how long he'd been in a coma, but he knew it had been long enough that he couldn't hope to actually have any friends anymore. He'd been out of commission for too long, understandably forgotten. He'd had an older brother, Jesse, but Jesse had been long gone from home before Jimmy came along. They hadn't been close when Jesse had died. Jimmy had gone to the funeral, of course, but hadn't cried. His brother's ex-wife had been there front and center, Shauna. She'd looked devastated. The year before, Shauna and Jesse had gotten a divorce. For months, it was all Jimmy's mother would talk about. It was clearly her opinion that Jesse should have stayed living in the same house with Shauna, raising their kids, but Jesse hadn't wanted to do that. He was 40 years old, and Shauna was 26. Jesse was having an early-onset midlife crisis. That's what Jimmy's father, Rory, had said. He'd told Jimmy it had happened to him, too. With a twinkle in his eyes, Rory told Jimmy that Jimmy almost never was. A friend of Rory's had invited him out after work on the pretense of a casual drink to dissuade Rory from divorcing Janine. Using his own misery as a cautionary tale, he'd warned that there was a time in every man's life when his emotions ran high, and that he could plainly see that Rory was in the thick of it. Manopause. And that as appealing as a breakup seemed, that Rory's male menopausal logic was flawed and couldn't be trusted. And Jimmy's dad had looked at the man's sorrowful eyes and seen the man's pleading hands and known that what the man was telling him was to be believed or discounted at his own peril. And Rory had stayed with Jimmy's mom. Sure enough, Jimmy's dad told him, after about a year of feeling like freedom from marriage was the answer, the mood left him, and he thanked the moon and the stars that he'd listened to the old gray fox and stayed with his wife. Jimmy had asked his dad if he'd told Jesse that same story, but Rory had sniffed, turning back to the paper, shaking his head. No, he doesn't listen. Considering what was at stake, Jimmy thought his dad ought to at least try. After all, Jimmy understood. But Jimmy's father seemed resigned. Jimmy didn't press the issue. He'd heard Rory tell his mother more than one time that nobody gets extra money from the universe for changing anybody else's mind. Even at the tender age of 16, Jimmy understood the wisdom of his father's words. Trying to convince others of anything is a poor use of your own precious time. The morning of Jesse's funeral was the last time Jimmy had seen Shauna. She had two children. One of them was Jesse's. She'd made Jimmy an uncle. He'd been mildly pleased at the idea of having a kid to show around, but when their marriage got rocky before Jesse's daughter was born, instead of asking for Shauna's number from his parents and forming his own relationship with the baby, his niece, he had let the opportunity fade. His parents, of course, had kept in touch with Shauna, but, especially after the divorce, they didn't spend holidays together. Shauna's family was Jewish, and for the holidays, they did their Jewish things. Jimmy's mom was Jewish, but at the Jennings' house, they celebrated Christmas. They gave Jimmy's mother Hanukkah presents too, but they were honorary. What amounted to the Jennings' Hanukkah celebration was meaningful in a family way, but wouldn't have been acceptable to any practicing Jew. Shauna and Jesse spent holidays in Calabasas with Shauna's family. Jimmy was always invited, but with the exception of one time, he had habitually arranged to be out of town for the holidays. Jimmy liked to party and preferred catching sunburn at a resort someplace tropical to traveling from one relative's house to the next, delivering Christmas and Hanukkah presents. Some years, he'd been able to find a like-minded travel mate, someone eager to escape holidays, the smell of family, love, and the lack thereof. Jimmy would hire a limousine and hit whatever nightclubs in town he'd heard mentioned in rap songs or that were otherwise known to be frequented by celebrities. Even if it was a place they used to go, he still wanted to have a little taste. For the last 2 years in a row, he'd bought himself a ticket to Brazil. He'd spent more money on hookers and cocaine than he had for the penthouse he'd rented with the view of a popular beach. It had come as a surprise that he could lead such a shot-calling, big-balling lifestyle there. He'd extended his trip and stayed until his money had run out. As soon as he returned stateside, Jimmy began putting money aside to spend on pussy and blow for his return trip to Brazil during Hanukkah the following year. The year before Jesse's heart attack, Jimmy had spent Hanukkah with Shauna and Jesse at the Leventhals. That year, Janine and Rory were celebrating an anniversary with a self-conducted pilgrimage to Israel. Obviously his mother's idea, but just as interesting to Rory Jennings as any place else. All Rory cared about when it came to a vacation destination was that there were no bears and no snakes. Janine Jennings had petitioned the year before for a trip to India. Rory was game at first, but when he looked into the place and saw images of a wild, dangerous, hungry snake, big enough to eat a person, wriggling down a city street, he vetoed that bill. When Janine mentioned Israel, he'd jumped at the chance. Rory, a hobbyist historian, wanted to see the people of such an iconic place, hear the old language spoken all around himself, and sniff the air and taste authentic Israeli food. Having decided to make the most of their trip, Rory and Janine left Los Angeles and had been gone long before the holiday. But before they'd left, Jimmy's mother had arranged for Jimmy to join the Leventhals for Hanukkah without consulting him. He was sure she'd done this on purpose, and had asked him, in a reasonable voice, if he wouldn't mind just showing up for a little while. He didn't have to stay all night, she'd said, but he had. The Leventhals kept the wine flowing. Surprisingly, it wasn't kosher wine. It was just regular wine, and good. They'd hired caterers and domestic help to bring out food and take away finished plates between courses. They really went all out. Both sets of the Leventhal grandparents were there. They'd flown in from Morocco the day before and had spent the last 18 hours cooking. The shameless pride each took in their own unique execution of their family recipes was high comedy. There was an air of jovial competitiveness between the two elderly couples for whose version of a dish tasted the best. There were duplicates of some dishes, baba ganoush, for instance, and the drunker everyone got, the funnier the comments got about how good it was to eat their baba ganoush and the various ways in which it was superior. As more bottles opened and the wine continued to flow, the showboating intensified, and the more the elders goaded people into giving their impressions of appeal, taste, and texture, like a food judge on Top Chef, immodestly scrutinizing each face for a favorable reaction as dinner guests lifted their forks to sample their edible masterpieces. It was a magical night. Jimmy should have stayed in touch with Shauna. He should have sent her parents holiday cards at least. But he hadn't. He could have even delegated this task to his assistant, but he hadn't bothered. Why? It would have only felt a little awkward the first time. He should have ignored the awkwardness and made it a point to spend time with both of Shauna's kids. It wouldn't have been right to visit one and exclude the other. He could have even gone to spend time with the kids when his own parents had plans to see them. He could have tagged along with Rory and Janine when they picked up the kids for weekends at their timeshare in Malibu. But even when Jimmy didn't have shit going on, he was still too busy. In retrospect, Jimmy thought he must have looked like a self-absorbed asshole. Jesse, as per usual, was distant, plus already wrapped up in some sticky relationship with a married woman much older than Shauna. Jimmy hadn't heard that from his mother. He'd seen it himself one afternoon, playing hooky from work, lurking around the Grove, an upscale open-air mall built around the historic farmer's market. Jimmy often visited the Grove when he had time between sales appointments. It was a cheerful place with shopping, nice restaurants, and a fountain that gave dramatic water performances to Frank Sinatra songs on the hour. Jimmy could stand and watch the fountain shoot its water into the sky for hours, which is what he'd been doing when he recognized his brother. Jesse and his other woman had been seated outside at one of the bar tables on an outdoor patio of some French steakhouse, Morel's. She was glamorous looking, probably famous, but they were tacky kissing in public like they needed a room. Jimmy took a very dim view of Jesse from then on. Jimmy genuinely liked Shauna. She was good people, and her family was warm and welcoming. The Leventhals were rich and clearly came from a long line of rich people, but they were kind and interesting and artistic and down to earth. At the Leventhals, nobody turned on the television after dinner. Everyone performed, entertaining each other with songs and skits. A neighbor's old Russian uncle had brought his violin and played. Some of Shauna's family openly wept. The vibrato was so haunting and beautiful. Two kids that had looked about 12 years old had entertained the family in the backyard with a sparring match refereed by Shauna's dad, Mr. Leventhal. It was informal, but the kids were obviously taking lessons. Their little impromptu routines were sharp. Another neighbor had asked her daughter to sing, and she performed some piece of an opera, so sultry that it blew Jimmy's mind, and he had to ask the woman's daughter what the name of it was. It was Habanera from Carmen. Mr. Leventhal and somebody's son played some acoustic duets on the guitar. At 10 o'clock, Shauna's grandparents kissed each person individually and said good night. They'd each kissed and hugged Jimmy too, and patted his cheek with wet eyes. It made him feel like they were glad he'd been there. He'd accepted Mrs. Leventhal's invitation to sleep in one of the guest rooms, and had fallen asleep to the sounds of old folks laughing, feeling happy, slightly drunk, and well-loved. That's what it was. The reason Jimmy hadn't stayed in touch with Shauna. Why he never reached back to her family. He was ashamed. He hadn't wanted to be associated with his brother after all the hurt and disappointment Jesse had caused Shauna's family. And seeing Jesse shamelessly looking like a male prostitute in a bar had left Jimmy feeling especially disgusted. In his mental efforts to disassociate himself with his brother, he had disassociated himself with his brother's kid and his ex-wife and her family, too. In hindsight, everyone has 20/20 vision. Jimmy tossed Sleeping Beauty's stylus back into the pile of her purse stuff and wondered if her spirit was watching him go through her things. He whipped his head around to look behind him, but he didn't see anything except for his own corpse propped up in the bed, looking hideously dead. He hoped this woman would be okay. If she didn't come around soon, he was going to have to do something. Like what? Jimmy hoped that she would wake up before he had to try to come up with something. The woman began to stir, finally. She blinked a few times, then looked around at the mess. Probably trying to put together where she is, Jimmy thought, or whether or not she was dead and why she was laying on the floor. The woman put her palms face down and pushed herself into a downward dog, separating herself from the floor. She stared straight ahead into Jimmy's obviously not peacefully sleeping face. She picked up her iPhone, her purse things, and her smoothie cup. Then, without turning her back on the cooling body of Jimmy Jennings, she backstepped reverently to the door until her butt hit the doorframe, where she reached the hand without the phone in it behind her back, opened the front door, and backed out. Jimmy heard the door lock. She's probably gone to call an ambulance, he figured. He had a feeling there wasn't much time left to spend with himself now that his body had been discovered. He didn't know what his travel options were, but he knew that he didn't want to spend much more time in this house. Leaving with his body might be the only way his ghost could leave the house. He wished he could call upon Beetlejuice to show him the ropes, somebody whose job it was to explain to him what he was still doing here, or at least teach him the basics of haunting and being a ghost. When the door opened the next time, it was a paramedic. Another paramedic was squatting on the doorstep, dealing with the housekeeper, who was in shock. She'd never seen a dead body. She called Jimmy, Mr. Jennings, which made Jimmy smile inside. It was the first time he'd heard himself called that, and not thought it was in reference to his father. As the medics prepared to remove Jimmy's body from beneath his 1800 thread count sheet and Egyptian cotton bedding, he looked at himself one last time as he'd lived. When the paramedics lifted the stretcher up and wheeled him away, Jimmy's conscious, thinking personality skirted through the open door alongside his empty, lifeless body.
Thank you for being here with me for the Afterlife Podcast. Join me next week for episode 5, Hollywood Forever. Did you enjoy this podcast? Subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And follow me, the author, Maximilian, on Twitter at Maximilian, MaxxiMillian. I would love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.